in between courts, so take your time on getting set up. Have you had an opportunity to sign the sign-in sheet?
I did.
Okay.
Thank you.
Whenever you're ready.
Thank you.
And would you care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
3 minutes, please, Your Honor.
Yes, sir.
Good morning. I'm David Moyer, representing Ronald Malone in this appeal. So the position, there's only one issue in the case, and our position is that the court below erred in not suppressing the firearm that was recovered from the defendant because it was as a direct result of the illegal seizure of him or was a proximate cause of the illegal seizure.
Counsel, in your brief and in the trial court's findings, it appears that both the trial court and you agreed that there was an unlawful detention, which is different than an unlawful arrest, correct?
What I believe the record shows and what the trial court ruled is that the defendant in this case was detained, that it started out as a consensual encounter and devolved into a detention and seizure once Officer Keel placed his hands on the defendant. And at that point in time, the lower court ruled that the officer didn't have a reasonable or articulable suspicion based on the complaints that were via 911 to seize the defendant.
And whether this is a distinction that makes any sense in the real world, and setting that consideration aside, we have cases that seem to suggest, well, they don't seem to suggest, they state that you are privileged to use force to repel an unlawful arrest, but you are not privileged to use force to repel an unlawful detention. Accepting that that dichotomy is what we're bound by, whether we like to be bound by it or not, and given the deference we owe the fact finder, can we say that the evidence was insufficient to find that your client resisted the detention?
Was insufficient to show that he resisted the detention as opposed to a seizure or arrest?
Well, I mean, there's an unlawful... A seizure can either be an arrest or a detention. It seems that the trial court found that it was an unlawful detention, and your brief tracks that language. So if we're dealing with a detention and not an arrest, is there sufficient evidence in the record for a reasonable fact finder to conclude that there was some degree of resistance or obstruction regarding the detention by your client?
Well, I think yes. It's reasonable to... I think that the evidence is pretty clear that he resisted the detention or attempted arrest, whatever you want to call it. But when Officer Keel grabbed his hands to frisk him because he objected to the frisk, it's at that point that he broke away from that grip and tried to run away. I think that the record is pretty clear regarding that. And then at that point in time, he, I think it's also pretty clear based on the entire record, including the trial of the case, that that he got away as far as 2 to 3 steps at most when the three officers took him to the ground to secure him. And then on the way down to the ground, one of the officers said that he struck him. The other officer said that he placed his hand, saw the defendant's hand at his right side of his waistband. And based on that, the officer put his hand where the defendant's hand was, removed the defendant's hand, and saw the butt of a gun. Recovered that. He was
and
secured in place. I'm sorry.
And the body cam video is not of such a quality or angles and things that we can't find that the trial court was unreasonable in reaching those factual conclusions.
I don't think so. Okay. And at that point in time, he is placed under arrest and then he is searched incident to arrest and the cocaine is found. The lower court ruled that the granted the motion as to the drugs, and so therefore this court is bound by that ruling, in my view, and that ruling is that the officer did not have reasonable suspicion, articulable suspicion.
Counsel, why wouldn't this be a new and distinct crime exception to
The reason is... Finding the weapon.
And what the distinction I draw is that I did not raise any objection or offer, as in Brown versus City of Danville, a motion to dismiss the gun charge, I'm sorry, the assaulting of a police officer, because his conduct, alleged conduct in assaulting the police officer, is not suppressible. It's a conduct or action by the defendant. You don't have a free shot at hitting police officers or shooting them just because they illegally seize you.
But part of the testimony that the officer gives is that he's essentially going for a gun as a part, or what could be considered as part of the assaultive behavior. So wouldn't that be a new distinct crime?
I don't believe that that's, first of all, the way that was articulated, and if you look at the trial court testimony and the record as a whole, the testimony is that he concluded that, and if I was a police officer, I would conclude the same thing because I'd be scared that was going to happen. But
and right at that point, though, we're not, he doesn't even have to conclude beyond a reasonable doubt. He just, given that you would conclude the same thing in that circumstance, doesn't that definitionally mean he had probable cause to believe a crime was occurring in his presence?
No, I don't think you have probable cause. You're worried that something may happen. I don't think that there's any crime at that point in time other than this defendant is resisting. If this defendant was charged with resisting arrest or obstruction of justice, I would not move to suppress that conduct because that's separate conduct that's not suppressible. The objects are tangible objects that were on his person that were recovered within
but
seconds.
But could it be argued that the possession of the weapon was part and parcel of that separate conduct, such as either the obstruction and or the assaultive behavior?
It was, but that weapon was not recovered until after the officer seized it and after he was, within seconds after he was illegally seized.
But if he illegally resists, okay, at that point, doesn't the officer have probable cause to effectuate full-on arrest if he wants to?
Yes. And
then the gun is discovered.
Yes, but the drugs were recovered after the gun, and the court below ruled that that was a product of the illegal seizure.
Well, and the court may have done something inconsistent with it's two things, and you may be right that one of them is not before us because of the law of the case, but one of them is clearly before us.
That's correct, but I believe that the case law is the case law that supports a separate and distinct crime is completely distinguishable from this case. The case cited, the federal case sprinkled, cited by the Commonwealth and by the AG in their case, involved. Similar to the extent that there was a suspicion to stop and search someone, and they ruled that they didn't have the reasonable suspicion to do so. In that case, the defendant ran over like a two blocks or something like that. And while he was running behind a house, then he pulls his gun out and starts shooting at the officer. Well, that conduct is sufficiently attenuated to remove the taint of the prior illegal seizure. In this case, Judge Fulton described this confrontation. It was a scrum. It happened within seconds.
Isn't arguably part of the distinction in terms of the drugs versus the gun that the drugs itself were found after the arrest was effectuated, and that arguably the weapon was a part of either the assaultive or obstructive conduct. Is that a delineation that the court credibly made?
I think that they did, obviously. I think that the trial court
I'm asking, is it a credible distinction, though?
No, I don't think it is, because, first of all, I think the court was correct in ruling that the drugs were not recoverable as search incident to arrest because the detention and seizure was illegal. That's the court's ruling in that case. The fine distinction that the court below made was that the conduct in resisting in an instant after being illegally detained, which resulted eventually in the finding of the gun, is different. It's distinguishable as a separate and distinct crime, and I don't see that distinction at all. And the court incorrectly stated that the defendant produced the gun. The defendant never produced the gun. The officer says he put his hand over top of
it. And you raise that, I think, around page 118 in the joint appendix. The transcript at 118, and the trial court eventually and the Commonwealth also conceded that you were correct in that, and the trial court eventually said, That's correct. And so it seems to me the trial court moved away from he pulled the gun to he was reaching for the gun.
I think you're right. He already did. But when the court made its ruling eventually and what's cited in the Attorney General's brief goes back to the language that produced the gun. It's arguable that if he drew the gun and pointed it at the officer, then I think that you have a separate and distinct crime of brandishing a firearm that attenuates the taint. This happened so quickly, he could have just as easily been reaching to throw away, try to get him, separate himself from the gun.
But is the risk, is you've conceded that there was sufficient evidence for the court to conclude that there was resisting going on.
Right, and as an officer, if I was a police officer, I wouldn't take my chances on the street because I can't, but that doesn't govern the legal ruling.
But resisting itself is an independent crime.
It is, and I could not suppress the conduct that associated with resisting because it was separate and distinct from the illegal
right.
seizure of the defendant. These were tangible objects that were recovered as a direct and proximate result of the illegal detention within seconds.
But given the temporal sequence, why isn't it discovered as a natural and proximate result of arresting him for resisting?
Because I don't think there's any case law that supports that, and the case law cited by the Commonwealth is easily distinguishable because the taint is purged by the intervening conduct of the defendant. I don't think you have that here.
It's just that two to three steps is not a long enough period of time. 15 to 20 steps would have been.
I'm not suggesting that the court establish a bright line rule, and I think the court probably doesn't want to ever do that in cases because every case is different. What I'm saying is that the case law on this subject, particularly Brown and the federal case cited by the Commonwealth, Brown supports my position, and Sprinkle is inconsistent factually with the facts in this case. So I just think in this particular case, based on these facts that are before the court now, and based on the trial court's ruling below, that the recovery of the gun was a direct and proximate result of the illegal seizure without the intervening act necessary to purge the taint.
Thank you very much. Mr. Kerr.
May it please the court, Liam Curry on behalf of the Commonwealth of Virginia in this matter. Just to respond to a couple of quick points that were made by counsel. There's a factual finding that is made by the trial court that I think Judge Russell is hitting on this point, that some of the remarks of the trial judge were being taken out of context. The actual finding is that there was a scuffle, a fight broke out, so to speak, between the defendant and the officers, during the course of which the defendant was reaching for a gun, which was made apparent and viewable by the officers. While that does suggest that perhaps the officers saw it, it's made clear by his next statement that when they see him reaching for the gun, the defendant was attempting to get the gun in his hand and hold it in his hand where it could actually be fired. That's a factual finding of the court that's binding on this court if supported by the evidence.
But going back to the initial encounter that clearly starts off consensually.
Yes.
There is no probable cause, reasonable, articulable suspicion, or anything that would have justified the officer placing hands on this man, was there?
It does not. That issue is not before the
court. Oh, it's part of the analysis, so.
Oh, sure. Well,
what do you got?
The Commonwealth's position is that the lawfulness of the detention is not relevant under.
If it had been a full-on arrest, he would have been privileged to resist, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so there wouldn't have been a new or subsequent crime. He would have been allowed to run. He would have been allowed to elbow.
That's correct, Your Honor. There's no... because the...
Then what is the distinction between the laying on of the hands in this situation and a full-on arrest? To a citizen, what's the difference?
Well... the case law is clear that the defendant, Mr. Malone, was not allowed to resist the detention, whether it was lawful or unlawful.
Well, right, but how does he know the difference between an arrest and a detention in this circumstance? He's surrounded by three cops, and one of them is putting his hands behind his back.
Well, Your Honor,
doesn't that feel an awful lot like an arrest?
Your Honor, the appellant did not present an argument to this court on appeal that he was unlawfully arrested and that he had a right to resist that arrest. The finding of the trial court was that he was unlawfully detained. That finding wasn't challenged by either party on appeal.
I think his question was more the practical one of what's the practical difference between an unlawful detention and an unlawful arrest as far as a citizenry is concerned? How do you distinguish between the two? Once an officer starts placing hands on you to put your hands behind your back.
Well, in this case, Your Honor, the only evidence that was before the court was that he was stopped. It was a consensual encounter, and that he resisted attempts to be patted down for weapons.
I think he's asking, though, Mr. Curry, generally.
Oh.
Correct me if I'm wrong.
Perhaps I'm just not as prepared to answer that question as I should be. But
I mean, the verbal rejection of a pat-down, he's got every right in the world to do that. There's no question. Correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. What he is not allowed to do is to commit a new and distinct independent crime.
But what determines whether what his actions in the 2 to 3 steps could be viewed by the officers a new and distinct crime is whether he is privileged to resist, correct?
That's correct.
If he's privileged to resist, there has been no distinct crime.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so that turns on whether he's been arrested or whether he's detained.
That's correct.
What's the distinction?
Your Honor, I guess I'm just not prepared to give exact legal argument between what constitutes a seizure and what constitutes an arrest in this case, simply because no argument had been raised on appeal that he was under arrest. So I don't want to speak out of turn and unprepared in a position that might harm the Commonwealth's position.
And I'm going to ask a completely unfair question here.
Okay.
Because it's not your office that made this decision. If it all is a if the resisting is a new and distinct crime that permits the arrest, and then, of course, they search incident to that arrest, why not appeal the suppression of the cocaine?
Why didn't the Commonwealth appeal?
Yeah. I recognize it's an unfair question, and you can just tell me that you have no idea, and that's fine.
I have no idea. My suspicion would be that they were satisfied with the amount of evidence that they were going to be able to present at trial, and that they didn't feel that an appeal that may delay the opportunity to try the defendant was worth.
They get the mandatory time with the firearm, so that's good enough.
Correct, Your Honor. I'm trying to think of some other points that were raised by my opponent. There was an argument about the recovery, when this firearm was recovered. I think the most important fact is not the recovery, but the discovery of the firearm. I think there's a couple of ways in which a defendant could prevail in the situation. If you're in the situation where there is an unlawful detention, and if these officers had effectuated a pat-down of this defendant, which there's no evidence that they did, the evidence is that they attempted and that the defendant eluded and then the melee kind of broke out. If they had, as a direct result of that unlawful detention, unlawfully patted down this defendant and discovered the firearm at that point, that would be a situation that would be similar to the Gaines case from the Fourth Circuit, where that chain of events was illegal detention, discovery of the item sought for suppression, and then there was subsequent illegal conduct.
Well, and I guess once again, getting back to how does the citizen respond to the officer in the real world, if he doesn't resist by essentially assuming a frisk position, even though he has verbally said don't do it, don't we have cases saying that assuming the stop and frisk position is acquiescence and consent to the frisk? So if he moves, he's in trouble. If he doesn't move, he's in trouble.
Your Honor, my response would be that there is the case law is clear that a defendant does not have the right to resist a pat-down. lawful or unlawful, that the remedy for that situation is the application of the exclusionary rule, and that defendants are presumed to know the law. There was another point, I think it was a reference to Sprinkle, about the matter that the defendant had only managed a few steps in Sprinkle compared to the defendant in Malone's case had only managed to move a few steps before he resisted arrest, whereas in Sprinkle that he had gotten away by several blocks before he ultimately pulled a gun and fired on the officers.
Counsel, let me stop you briefly in reference to the new and distinct crime. One of the things you argue on brief is that the new and distinct crime is a concealed weapon. Isn't that something that would have occurred throughout? So how is that new and distinct?
I think the Commonwealth's position on appeal is that the trial court made a factual finding that the defendant had committed an assault of the officers, and that the firearm was part of the assault. I don't think that it's the Commonwealth's position that merely having the concealed weapon itself was the new and distinct crime.
But the trial court also acquitted him of assault and battery of a law enforcement officer. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. But for the purposes of whether he was lawfully arrested for assault, the officer certainly had probable cause to believe that he had committed an assault.
And your position is that carries with it the right to search incident to arrest?
The Commonwealth's position is that the gun was evidence of a new crime, because the trial court found that he was trying to arm himself in front of the officers, that is evidence of the new crime, that the assault and battery that the officers believe was taking place did involve the attempted use of a firearm, and that it was discovered during the criminal acts of the defendant. I know that that Mr. Malone argues that the Augustus case would require the suppression of the firearm in this case, but there's simply no evidence to support the theory that the firearm in this case was discovered and seized in a search incident to arrest. The testimony is that the officer detected the firearm while they were still scuffling with the defendant. It's not a situation where, we have the body camera footage. It doesn't show clearly what happened, but it supports the trial court's conclusion that the gun was discovered before the physical altercation with the defendant had ended. It's not a situation in which the defendant was subdued, picked up, arrested, and then subsequently searched incident to that arrest for assault. So that kind of loops back into the new and distinct crime exception, that because the firearm was being used, or was attempted to being used, and was discovered as a direct result of the defendant's criminal conduct, it is admissible under the new and distinct crime exception.
Now, one thing I'm a little bit confused about on that is you say that the trial court was relying upon the intended use of the gun to help support the assaultive conduct, but I thought the trial court, in acquitting the defendant of that conduct, said essentially there was no intent, that it was kind of flailing around, so he was relying upon the defendant's use of his hands and elbows in the assaultive conduct, because I think he found that he simply didn't have the intent to injure the officers.
Well, the testimony of the...
I guess to boil down my question,
sure,
to something that's a little more intelligible, didn't he acquit Mr. Malone on the assault and battery of a law enforcement officer by finding that there was no intent?
I don't think that the fact that he was ultimately acquitted of the assault renders the fact that there wasn't probable cause.
I'm not talking about probable cause. I'm talking about the judge's reasoning. You're saying the judge was using the firearm to form the basis for discussing the assault and battery, but I didn't find that to be the case, if only because the trial court, in explaining why he was acquitting the defendant, relied upon a lack of intent. And if you're saying somebody's reaching for the gun to use it in the course of assaulting the officers, I'm not sure how you get to a lack of intent on that, as opposed to in the scrum, as you were talking about, when somebody's flailing around and makes contact. Then I can see a lack of intent there, not purposefully reaching for a gun. None of that has anything to do with probable cause. Sure. But we're just talking about, I think you were mentioning, the reason the judge was getting to discussing assault and the use of the weapon.
Right. I guess I'm a little confused, and I know I'm sure it's on my end, but
I don't necessarily agree with that.
So is the point you're making, Judge Attlee, that after the suppression hearing that the trial judge reevaluated the evidence in terms of reevaluating his finding from before that assault involved?
That is part of what I'm asking you about. Yes, sir.
My interpretation of the record is that the defendant was acquitted of the assault and battery. He was convicted, I guess, of the concealed weapon charge and
possession by a convicted felon, violent felon.
Right. I do not think that the fact that the acquittal of the assault charge has any legal bearing on the evidence that the trial court used in denying the motion to suppress the firearm. Don't know if that answers your question, but
we view the totality of the record, correct?
Yes, but I think in viewing, we also view it in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth at this stage, and I think viewed through that light, the evidence.
Well, we can't view it in the light that he's guilty of assault and battery because, well, he's not.
Yes, it's not the Commonwealth's position that the trial court should have convicted him of assault and battery. It's just that the trial court's decision to deny the suppression of the firearm was supported by the record.
Your focus is on the probable cause, not the ultimate result.
That's correct, Your Honor. See, I'm almost out of time. I guess if there are no further questions, I'd just like to ask that this court affirm the decision of the trial court, just to prevent that a situation where there's an unlawful detention. We certainly don't want to create, just because there's an unlawful detention, we don't want to create a license or an invitation to violently resist that action, particularly in a case such as here, where the defendant was illegally in possession of a deadly weapon.
Thank you, Mr. Curry. Mr. Moyer?
I just want to make one point, Your Honor. With regard to the trial court's finding on guilt or innocence on the assault of the law enforcement officer, it's important, in my view, because viewing the totality of the record before you, it really illuminates more clearly how this happened and how quickly it happened. That's the trial court is the one who's characterized this incident as a scrum. All the activity was going on within seconds, flailing about, the elbows, three officers, my client. All that took place within seconds. And the court has made the distinction below that having his hand in the area where the gun is, officer removing it and seeing the butt of the gun, represents a separate and distinct crime. And I think factually it's important when you look at the totality of the record that that's inconsistent with what the case law is on separate and distinct crime. And my point from the outset was you can't suppress the conduct.
Counsel, is your position, though, that a new and distinct crime has to always result in a conviction?
No, not at all. Not at all. What my point was at trial court, and is now, is that I would get nowhere with a motion to suppress the conduct that supports a resisting arrest or an attempt to brandish a firearm, which I think under these facts is not even
can't even come to that conclusion. But the tangible objects that were recovered as a result of the illegal detention necessarily and quickly flow from the illegal detention.
Is the detention from the assault and the potential assault and battery an illegal detention? We've been talking about what the trial court found. The trial court acquitted him of the charge ultimately. But, of course, to acquit somebody of a charge of assault and battery, somewhere along the line, some judicial process has determined that there was probable cause that an assault and battery occurred, or we don't even get to the stage where you get acquitted.
Yes.
And so the question then becomes, was it a lawful detention? Could they lawfully detain him for the potential assault and battery?
Well, once a police officer is able to articulate that he's struck during the attempt to secure him, then he has probable cause to arrest him for assaulting a law enforcement officer.
Well, then why isn't the gun just simply discovered search incident pursuant to that lawful arrest?
Well, I think that the Commonwealth has taken the position that this is not a search incident to arrest because of the trial court's ruling below.
But we can affirm on any reason.
Yes, sir.
I think
that it's hard to make
that
distinction.
Tell me why I shouldn't do that.
Because everything happened so quickly, that would be factually inconsistent with what happened here. He was detained, and then there's a struggle, all of which happens in a second, so now you have a gun and you have cocaine, and all these charges flow from that. The reason why all these objects were, I'm not making a but-for argument, because that wouldn't win. The argument I'm making is clearly that this is a quickly sequential result of an illegal detention, and that this conduct that the defendant exhibited by hitting a police officer and struggling is not suppressible. That conduct is not suppressible. Those tangible objects are. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We will come down and greet counsel.